From the Moment Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. From Pelosi and Schiff to Nunes and McCarthy, California's congressional representatives have big roles in the impeachment of President Trump. But now that they all have to go back to Capitol Hill, we'll hear how much the last few months has widened the partisan divide. Plus, quick, name two things that go great together. Bread and butter, PB&J. How about hot chicken sandwiches and car washes? Yeah, it's a thing. Hear about it on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. It's Friday, and we've got a great show for you today. Coming up, if you're looking to make your next big blockbuster movie, you should know there's a shortage of studio space in Los Angeles. We'll tell you why. Plus, the deadline to get a real ID is fast approaching, people, and if not enough of you are going to the DMV to get one, we're going to talk to the head of the Department of Motor Vehicles about why this could make for a big cluster come October. All that coming up in just a few minutes. But we start this Friday with State of Affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, the many California lawmakers who've played key roles in the impeachment of President Trump. From manager Adam Schiff and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Representative Kevin McCarthy and Devin Nunes. And now that the trial is behind us, we're going to talk about what's next for both parties. Jack Pitney joins us this week. He's a Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Also with us, Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Carla, welcome back as well.
Good to be with you.
All right, let's dive in right now and talk about Speaker Pelosi. She received a praise and criticism over her decision to tear up her copy of President Trump's State of the Union speech. Now at least one op-ed is calling for her to step down. Carla, what's Pelosi said in response to the criticism she has received?
Well, hey, you know, we talked to Pelosi's daughter, Christine Pelosi, this week to get the lowdown, and she described her mother's actions as a classic Italian grandma move. Mm. And I have to tell you, having an Italian grandma, I can confirm it did look that way. That is, the message to President Trump was, you're misbehaving in my house and basta, you know. I mean, but look, this was a serious thing. Pelosi said this was a courteous thing to do, considering what she felt was the content of the speech. She said it reflected the president's state of mind, but not the state of the union. And by the way, the state of mind, she said later, was sedated. I mean, it was rancorous. Pelosi's been in politics a long time. She's seen people come and go. She knows how to create a viral moment. And I think she knows exactly what she was doing when she did that dramatic rip up. Yeah. Remember when she emerged from the Oval Office with that red coat and sunglasses last year, and she did the clap back. She is very much known to get under his skin and knows how to do it. And I think in this case, the speaker did step on his speech in a way. She got her message across, you know, basta. And she did it in Italian grandma style. So, yes, she's getting criticism, but Democrats are definitely giving her applause.
Yeah, there's a lot of people on social media who loved what she did, yet there was another side. Op-ed from Jonathan Turley, who people might remember as the Republicans' witness from the House impeachment hearings. He makes the case that Pelosi shredded decades of tradition and decorum at a time when it's needed more than ever. And I want to get your read on this, Jack, on Pelosi's public behavior throughout the impeachment chapter. You can start from the souvenir pens. She fist bumps Bill Maher on his HBO show. She rips the speech. Has she added to the nation's political polarization in recent weeks?
On substance, she handled it very, very skillfully. On the optics, some of them were not so good. The ripping, I don't think that added to the discussion. She adopted the stance, which was appropriate, of more in sorrow than in anger. That tended to convey more anger than sorrow. If I'd been advising her instead of the Italian grandma, I would have recommended the Irish grandmother response, and that is the icy, bone-chilling stare. And that would have been far more appropriate to the occasion.
And for those who may not have seen Bill Maher and Nancy Pelosi on the day she announced the impeachment or handed over the impeachment articles, Bill Maher put up his fist and said, "Thank you for waiting until I get back on the air to impeach Donald Trump." She gave him the fist bump, and there was that. Now, Carla, it's hard to deny that impeachment has been a major letdown for Democrats. It kind of just sucked all the air out of the news cycle since the inquiry was announced in September. With it over, polls show approval of President Trump is now at an all-time high for him. Did Democrats take a risk not using this time before the election to promote maybe more kitchen table issues?
Well, you know, Democrats felt impeachment was an important issue they could not sidestep. But I think they know they need to get back to the kitchen table very, very quickly, and they should be very, very afraid, I think, as they watch President Trump's State of the Union this week. He rolled out reelection themes as he did that speech. He talked up a blue-collar boom, that's the way he put it, in economy and jobs. And by the way, Ivanka Trump is also echoing that blue-collar boom today on Twitter. And that kind of pitch to working-class Americans, those are the kind who have traditionally been union members and Democrats, on the very kitchen table issues you're talking about, that could resonate big time in the Rust Belt states. You know, the president described America as being strong militarily, strong economically, strong at its borders. And by the way, he said, we will never let socialists take away your health care. That's another big kitchen table issue. So if he successfully portrays Democrats, no matter who's the candidate, as socialists who are weak on jobs, who are, you know, unable to get health care together, that could be an issue. So, yeah, definitely Democrats know they better pivot right now and quickly.
Jack, what about you? Could they have used that time differently?
Yeah, they could have been, talked about the weaknesses in the economic numbers. Manufacturing employment actually went down in the latest report. But more than that, and following on what Carla said, health care has usually been a big Democratic strength and a Republican weakness. The Republicans really lost ground in the 2018 election because of the health care issue. And they really need to think through what their presidential candidates are saying. Is Medicare for all really something that's going to appeal to people? I don't know. But if they just focused on preserving, protecting, and strengthening Obamacare, that would be a winning issue.
You know, and on the jobs report that Trump touted in the State of the Union, an op-ed in the Washington Post says that this has been a good week for President Trump and getting better. So, and you got to also factor in the Iowa caucus debacle, too, which highlighted some of the challenges in the Democratic Party. Jack, if Democrats came to you today and said, okay, how do we combat this? What would you suggest?
Well, again, going off on the health care, emphasize that. Emphasize, again, the kitchen table issues. Some of the candidates are doing a very good job of that, talking about the struggles of ordinary Americans and pointing out that with the tax cut, most of the benefit of the tax cut went to the richest Americans. Polls show that is a message that does, in fact, resonate with the general electorate.
We're talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Also, Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. All right, let's look at Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff, most recently an impeachment manager. And during an interview this morning with NPR's Steve Inskeep, he was asked if all of this was worth it. Here's what he said.
It was absolutely worth it. And we felt very strongly, and I think history will bear us out on this, that we needed to place a constraint on this president who was acting unethically, who was sacrificing our national security, who was jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. And whatever the result was going to be in the Senate, we couldn't sit still. We had a constitutional obligation to make the case.
Jack, it seems like Democrats had a difficult choice to make, do nothing and focus on winning an election or do something and then risk turning more people off from the Democrats. Is that the case or is that too simple? Or you think maybe Democrats thought the impeachment would make their argument and their political party more appealing?
Going into this, I think most of them understood how difficult a situation this was. This is why Pelosi and Schiff were very reluctant to go the impeachment route. Eventually, they did when they thought they had, as Schiff just said, a constitutional duty. So the question is, what would have happened if they didn't act? If they learned all of this material about what Trump was doing in Ukraine and they didn't try to stop it. You know, it's a situation where they might not have gotten the political gain that some had hoped for, but they have a powerful argument that they had a constitutional duty to do what they did.
Carla, Adam Schiff has said that his stance was that if he could just make one person change their mind, they could change history. And actually, Senator Mitt Romney did. He's now being called a rhino, Republican in name only. Could Mitt Romney be the first of many Republicans to challenge the party of Trump mentality? Or you think maybe the GOP will do everything they can to make an example of Mitt Romney?
Well, you know, we've already seen a pretty noteworthy group of Republicans, including John Weaver, a veteran strategist, former McCain guy, Schwarzenegger advisor Mike Murphy, And a lot of California's GOP strategists, Mike Madrid, Rob Stutzman, who is also with Schwarzenegger, and Luis Alvarado here in California, aligned themselves with a group called the Lincoln Project. That is a sort of a renegade group of Republicans who are calling on the party to protest what they think is a takeover of the party by Trump. But, you know, that was before Romney spoke. And, you know, now that his head is on a pike, so to speak, he is getting punished for what he did. Republicans up there on the Hill are holding their breath to see how much retribution he's going to face. And we're seeing some of the retribution as we're on the air, with Lieutenant Colonel Vindman being walked out of the White
Escorted House. Escorted out, yeah.
Escorted out and losing his job. So right now, I think it was sort of striking to see the silence from Romney's Senate colleagues who have known him for years, who have respected him. There was no pushback on Trump's insults other than from Pelosi. So right now, you're seeing some of Trump's allies, including Kevin McCarthy, join on the bandwagon to bash Romney. Well, we'll see how this all plays out.
But Carlo, this Lincoln Project that you described, is it more a kind of a never Trump extension, or is it a move to maybe bring the GOP more to the middle?
Yeah, they describe themselves, a lot of them describe themselves as never Trumpers, but they're saying it is time to remake the Republican Party, to bring it down and build it up again from the ground up after Trump. They go back to conservative principles. A lot of these folks are conservatives when it comes to budget, when it comes to government growth, and many of the other things that Reagan stood for. They hold Reagan as their standard bearer. So, you know, right now they've got ads up and they expect to get stronger and raise more money. We'll see how that goes.
Now, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said Thursday that he doesn't think Mitt Romney is effective in any shape or form. McCarthy is among others like Mitch McConnell and Devin Nunes, who received praise for their loyalty during Trump's so-called victory speech on Wednesday. Trump has said McCarthy would become Speaker if Republicans wind up taking back the House. Jack, as a former Republican, is it troubling to you that the message from the White House is loyalty will be rewarded, disloyalty punished?
To some extent, that's not new. During the Vietnam War, a senator from Idaho tried to explain to LBJ why he came out against the war. He quoted the columnist Walter Lippmann, and LBJ responded, "Well, next time you want a dam in Idaho, ask Walter Lippmann."
Wow.
So that's not it. What's new is this. Trump is out denouncing Romney in public, encouraging his supporters, putting out talking points. The Republican National Committee is attacking Romney. All that is new. That's unprecedented. Mm-hmm. And I think the level of vitriol is going to be something we haven't seen before.
So that's going to be the next thing to look at. If Utah needs something from the federal government, are they going to get it?
They're not going to get it through Romney.
No, maybe not for a while. No. So Carl, just to wrap up on Schiff a bit, what's next for Adam Schiff after this chapter?
Look, I mean, many Democrats say that Adam Schiff's performance has done a couple of things which could change his political future. He's become a hero to the party in the wake of this thing. He has upped his name idea big time nationally, and he has probably, I think, become a leading candidate for U.S. Senate here in California sooner rather than later. If Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's now 85, retires, you know, the betting pool previously suggested that Gavin Newsom would be hard pressed to replace a woman senator with a white man, and that he'd have to diversify. You know, Alex Padilla has been named a lot, Eleni Kunalakis, the lieutenant governor. But now many people are saying that Schiff could be tapped if that ever happens. And if it doesn't happen, I think he has really greatly improved his chances of being either, you know, in a future Democratic cabinet, if there is one in the next round, or maybe a run for office as senator or perhaps governor. I think his future looks pretty bright, at least on the Democratic side.
I want to try and squeeze in a couple of theoreticals here at the end. Jack, if President Trump wins a second term, what could a lame duck Trump presidency look like?
Probably not very happy. Second terms usually bring trouble. You look at the Clinton impeachment, the Nixon impeachment effort, Iran-Contra, all of those happened in second terms. That's where the chickens come home to roost. Also, in the case of Trump, he's had a lot of luck with the economy. Luck with the economy tends not to last forever. And in a second term, a recession could hit.
Carla, really quick, if President Trump wins a second term for the Democratic Party, could there be a reckoning?
Well, after the screaming is over on the Democratic side, yeah, you're going to hear calls for generational change. And remember, Pelosi faced those calls in the last election with the defeat of Clinton. But, you know, look for Democrats to head for the bunkers, and they're going to develop a plan to stop President Mike Pompeo or President Ivanka Trump from taking office in 2024. And they will have to do some very, very heavy lifting if that's the case.
Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Jack, Carla, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, if you're a chronic procrastinator, all of us here at KPCC, we understand. That's because this is a building full of journalists, you know, professional procrastinators who thrive on deadlines, but not everyone is wired that way. For many California drivers, deadlines are just suggestion, like stop signs. Coming up, why ignoring one deadline in particular may leave you all packed up with nowhere to go. That's ahead when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Less than an hour north of San Bernardino is the city of Adelanto. There, you'll find the Adelanto Detention Facility, a center where thousands of immigrants are detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Inside the building, people are held for sometimes months at a time as they apply for asylum or contest deportation. But even though it's not technically a prison, detainees allege a wide range of abuse. And a case settled last week between the center and several detainees gave the public a rare window into what happens inside the facility. NPR reporter Tom Dreisbach has been investigating this. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with that court case, which stemmed from an incident in the summer of 2017 during a hunger strike by a handful of detainees. There's a surveillance video without sound, and it shows the cafeteria area. Can you describe what happened there?
So it's a group of eight Central American immigrants who had crossed the border and they had sought asylum. They were then detained at the facility in Adelanto, and they thought that the conditions were terrible at this facility. They thought the food was essentially inedible. They complained that they didn't have access to clean water all the time and that they didn't even get clean underwear when they were at the facility. So what they decided to do was gave a list of their concerns and asked to see a supervisor either from ICE or from the facility, and they were going to go on hunger strike until they could talk to someone about their concerns. And at around 6:30 in the morning was the facility's count, where they basically make sure no one's escaped from the facility. And they told these eight detainees, you have to go to your bunks. Mm. They refused as part of their, you know, protest against the conditions. And in response, guards first showed up. They tried to physically remove them from two separate tables where they were sitting. When that didn't work, they then used pepper spray at least three separate times. And they removed them physically in some cases by dragging them along the floor, pushing them against walls. And the guards later claimed that the detainees were inciting a, quote, rebellion, which justified their use of force, although that's somewhat undercut by what you see on the footage, which is that the men tried to just stay seated while this was going on. After they were pepper sprayed, at least five of them were put in hot showers. And the issue with hot showers is that hot water actually reactivates the pepper spray and causes it to be more painful. And then they were placed in what's called segregation, which is a term ICE uses essentially for solitary confinement for 10 days.
And that video is really, really difficult to watch. But when it comes to their grievances, I mean, you got access to more documents filled with the grievances and complaints by other detainees about their treatment inside. What are some examples of what they had to say?
Through the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to obtain hundreds of detainee grievances about the issues at the facility. And of course, you know, some of those won't be founded. They might just be people, you know, complaining about their circumstances. But others were determined to be substantiated by the people who run the facility. Among those complaints were they complained of being harassed. They said that in one case, a detention officer said, I won't hesitate to drop you off your bunks. And they used language that we can't use on NPR or KPCC. In one case, a detainee alleged that a detention officer said, "I don't like Mexicans." And in another case, a detention officer allegedly made fun of a family of a detainee who were visiting during visitation hours and made fun of their accents. You know, it's among those complaints. And then in addition to those complaints, there are a lot of complaints about poor medical care, which federal inspectors have said was negligent medical care in the past. And people are alleging that they haven't been able to get medications or access to treatment on a timely basis or even get it at all.
Now, we should remind listeners that the people in this facility are not convicted criminals. However, in your reporting time, you found that there were other instances where the facility did not meet federal standards on things like solitary confinement and medical care for detainees. Can you tell us about that?
I think that's a really important point that you brought up. The people who are at this facility are mostly not convicted criminals. The majority have no criminal conviction. And in fact, when you go into the facility, they give you a handbook that says detention is not prison. It's a civil detention for people while they decide your immigration status. Now, some people have been convicted of crimes and they're awaiting deportation based on that. Many others are asylum seekers, and others are people simply who were in the country undocumented and were going through the deportation process and contesting that. And many of these people have contested conditions there, including, as you mentioned, the use of solitary confinement, mental health care. In some cases, the federal inspectors of this facility have said that the mental health care does not meet federal standards, and that in some cases, the facility was putting people in segregation or solitary confinement because they didn't know what else to do with someone with a severe mental illness. They didn't know where else to put them, and the federal inspector said that was negligent.
We're talking about the Adelanto Detention Facility with NPR reporter Tom Dreisbach. Now, although this facility is for people detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, it is owned and operated by the for-profit company GEO Group. What can you tell us about the kind of oversight and review that it gets from the government?
Yeah, GEO Group is a federal contractor. In the last 12 months, according to government data, it's received nearly $1 billion in federal contracting money. They are overseen by a sort of complex nesting and overlapping group of oversight agencies. There's the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General. There's the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. There's internal parts of ICE that inspect these facilities. But a lot of advocates and even parts of the government itself say these inspections are inadequate and that the federal government doesn't do enough with its contracting power to force changes for practices that they have found fault with. You know, for example, they say, you know, this facility recently had its contract renewed. It's been cited for all these issues. And yet it doesn't appear that ICE, when they were renewing that contract and had this power, this financial power to force changes, that they even used it. And the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General has said throughout the immigration detention system, ICE doesn't use its contracting power enough and the leverage it has over its contractors enough to force changes.
Has ICE said anything about these allegations of abuse and about the GEO Group itself?
ICE has declined to talk about the court case involving the pepper spray incident. They say they don't comment on litigation. GEO Group told me that they contest all of the allegations that were in the lawsuit that was filed by the detention by the detainees, and that they take all grievances that are determined to be credible. They take those seriously and take corrective action. But they did not provide any specifics about what kind of corrective action that was, whether it was disciplining a detention officer or firing them or what have you.
Now, despite these issues, and despite that California is moving to phase out facilities like this by 2028, Adelanto is set to expand. Why?
There was this new California law, which is supposed to largely end the use of private prisons and private companies in immigration detention. It went into effect on January 1st of this year. But in response to that law, after it was passed, but before it went into effect, ICE renegotiated a contract with GEO Group to run this facility and was able to sign a contract that actually expands it before January 1st, so at the end of December 2019. And as a result, they're kind of grandfathered in and expand the facility before it went into effect.
Is there a genuine push from inside the facility to reform? And if so, who's leading that?
there are pushes sometimes from Congress that you will see. There are these really alarming reports that we'll see from oversight agencies such as the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General or other parts of the government. But I think the thing to remember is the people in this facility are not citizens. And they may have family members who are citizens who can advocate with lawmakers, but they simply lack the kind of political power and the political pull with representatives that you might need to enforce real change at these kind of facilities.
That's NPR's Tom Dreisbach. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
All right, moving on. If you're thinking about taking a mini vacay in October, you know, a simple little flight to Tahoe for the weekend, for example, and you don't happen to have a passport, you're going to need a real ID. And if you don't have one of those, based on current data, you probably don't. You can forget about that trip. With only 8 months to go before the October 1st deadline to get the federally required ID, only about a quarter of California's 27 million licensed drivers have one. So I'll do the math for you. The DMV has to issue over a million real IDs a month to have all those folks federally compliant. DMV Director Steve Gordon joins us now. Steve, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you, Abe.
All right, so what gives? Are Californians just laid-back procrastinators, or should the DMV have done some screaming from the rooftops about this the last few months?
Well, I tell you, we've been screaming from the rooftops. I've been on your show a couple of times, as you know, and been on others, trying to get people aware that, you know, Real ID is a pressing deadline. And now it becomes more urgent. We want to move from awareness to giving people kind of strong nudges, strong, you know, shoves to get into the office, because you're right, and you're lead-in, right? And people are going to have their vacays disrupted if they can't get the right IDs.
What needs to happen? Does your boss, Gavin Newsom, need to give you some money for commercials? Or what needs to occur here for people to get the message?
I think the governor is doing everything he can. You know, we have a budget for advertising. We've been working with a local ad agency who's been working down multiple channels, you know, whether it be social, radio, print, billboards, multiple languages in targeted communities. We've been doing a lot of interviews like this. We've done phone banks in underserved communities. We've done speakers bureaus. We're doing everything we can possibly think of, but we're dealing with human nature. And unfortunately, people, I mean, we're people, right? We tend to procrastinate when this thing's in October. We don't see it as urgent today. So we're trying to continue to drum up support. LA Times article helped us a little bit, and we're trying to make sure that people realize this is a real hard deadline.
So how ready is the DMV, Steve, for what sounds like could be a crush of Californians getting in line?
Yeah, so good alliteration on crush of Californians. But no, we are working very hard to, you know, remove delays in the system. And as we discussed last time we were on your show, a couple weeks ago, right, one of the things we're doing is we're streamlining the process. We're using technology. This process started off a year ago at 28 minutes. Now we've just launched some process changes, and we have now the Real ID process itself down to around 10 minutes. And that rolled out statewide just this week. And so it'll probably be working at full speed probably by the middle of this month. So we've done a lot to make sure that there's capacity in the office and speed in the office so people don't have to wait very long. That's why wait times have come down as well.
So just because the number seems daunting, seems almost undoable, the technology is there to catch everyone up if this crush happens?
Man, we're trying. I mean, as you can imagine, if everybody shows up on the last day of the month, it'll be not possible to process them all in one day. But we're trying to encourage people to come forward. We're trying to put carrots out there. Of course, people think they need an appointment. That's something, unfortunately, we've drummed into their brain in the past. They don't need an appointment. Wait times have never been lower. We do text messaging. We tell you when it's your time at the window. We do a lot of things so you can do other things besides wait in our office. And we're also starting to experiment with concepts like same-day real-time appointments. If you've just completed your forms online or you just uploaded your docs, we're going to try to dangle the carrot. Come on in now. You know, you see those all the time with other advertising. They create a scarcity, a sense of urgency. We want to use those same techniques to get Californians in the office.
We're talking to DMV Director Steve Gordon. Now, just to remind everyone, especially those who clearly feel no compulsion to get one right now, what is the Real ID needed for?
Yeah, the Real ID is needed for travel primarily, and also for, you know, protected government facilities. There are some that require an ID to get in. Now, most people in those facilities have a military ID, for example, which gets you in those facilities. You can also, of course, use a passport or, you know, global entry, some of these other products that will suffice for travel and access to those facilities. But primarily, as you did with your lead, it's mostly people think about it for travel. They grab their ID because they can rent a car when they get to their destination. but they're going to need that ID to get through security through TSA, and come October 1st, the bar goes up and you need a real ID.
So to be clear, if say I'm someone who has no plans at all to travel, I don't have to get one?
That's correct. I mean, when you have your normal renewal for a license in California, I would encourage you at that time to go through the extra step to get a real ID versus just renew for a non-compliant card. But if you don't travel, right, there's no urgency to get anything. But if you expect you're going to travel or you're going to expect you're going to need to go out of state on a plane for any reason, you know, we should encourage you to come in now.
Now, Steve, you've been on the show a few times, and it's clear you have a very positive can-do attitude about the DMV, a place that many people think of with all kinds of hatred and dread. But come October 1st, what is a realistic measure of success on real IDs for you?
Well, I think a couple of realistic measures is, one, did we get it down so that it was approachable and effective for the residents of California? So that means, is it simple enough so people know what to do? Have we made it so that the process works in the counter so people can get in and out? Think about a typical retail shop we go to, a Starbucks or a McDonald's. We need to make sure people can get through that retail experience in a reasonable amount of time. That's 10 minutes or so, or maybe 5 minutes if we're really, really good. So that's one measure. And the other measure is, you know, have we truly been effective? And this is from the top of the government on down across the spectrum. Can we get people in to take the action that we know they need to take and take it now before that it's urgent? So I think those two things will be the primary measures of our success.
All right, that's DMV Director Steve Gordon. Steve, get back to work. Time's running out.
All right, thanks a lot for your time.
For many filmmakers, Los Angeles can be a beautiful movie-making canvas that offers countless combinations of backdrops. Beach, hills, buildings, streets, filming happens all over LA. But sometimes sound stages are needed. Well, Hollywood's got plenty of those, right? Nope, not anymore. Find out why the race for filming space is as tight as my Smedium t-shirt. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. The Frame is KPCC's arts and entertainment show, and John Horn, this weekend is what? The Super Bowl, the World Series, the Olympics, everything all wrapped into one for you, right? The Oscars weekend?
I think so. I think
you
got
probably,
it right.
Probably, right?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah, you got a lot of shows from now until then.
Well, we have a Frame Oscar special, and if you want to jot down these times, you can jot them down, because, A, I think you want to listen all three times.
I'm ready.
Tonight at 9. Saturday afternoon at 2 and Sunday at noon. We've got a bunch of top nominees, including likely winner Renee Zellweger, Parasite director Bong Joon-ho, who could win for international features.
I mean,
called
the buzz
now
is like
Best
the,
Director,
it could be there,
Best
right?
Picture.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be an interesting show. Yeah. I mean, we've got 1917 and Parasite fighting for the top prizes, and we'll see what happens.
John Horn in the Frame all weekend long. Tomorrow at 9, oh no, tonight at 9 p.m., Saturday at 2, and then Sunday at noon.
You got it right.
John Horn, thanks a lot. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The Los Angeles area has nearly 6 million square feet of film production space, and it's all booked up. With the boom of streaming services has also come a boom in film production, and people in the industry are finding that there aren't enough sound stages to go around. Now with us to discuss how Hollywood is dealing with the space race for studio stages is Anousheh Sakhoui, staff writer for the LA Times. Anousheh, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure, sure. Now, it seems like every day there are 10 new Netflix shows. I can't keep up. I don't have the headspace or actual life space to watch them all. Is that the main culprit for this dwindling amount of available production space in the city?
In a nutshell, yes. You know, Netflix was sort of number one, and it was already massively outspending its peers in Hollywood. You know, like most of the big studios that we all know of, Disney and Warner Brothers and Universal. Now, all those traditional studios, alongside Apple, Amazon, Google with YouTube, are all creating original content for their own streaming platforms. So there's that. And in addition to that, California has been fighting over the past few years to bring back production that had gone away over a certain period of time. So that combination has really put a pressure on the infrastructure of Hollywood.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, because there's the demand for production space in L.A. is high, but there's an overall drop in filming in L.A. So I was wondering how those two things square.
Yeah, no, exactly. I had the same question when I was writing about the annual, you know, film permitting data that came out a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to Film LA, who orchestrates all this for the county, and you know, Paul Audley, who's the president, said, you know, one of the things that they believe anecdotally is the reason is because of the shortage of space, producers are going elsewhere. I mean, we've definitely seen, you know, states like Georgia and New Mexico give really lucrative incentives, tax incentives to studios, and in the case of New Mexico, to make 10-year commitments, which Netflix and Universal took up, to build studios out there. So they're going elsewhere. I think the impression I get from people in the industry is that they don't necessarily want to, but to meet all their demands, they have to.
You mentioned Georgia. I got that jingle in my head, "Made in Georgia," that
right.
you see all the time.
It's the biggest production hub in the U.S.
No, wow.
It's been for a while.
Wow. Where else are they going other than Georgia?
You know, Louisiana, New York. You know, it's interesting. There's a lot going on in New York and in you know, New Jersey, where there's a lot of redevelopment going on. If you watched the State of the Union speech and you saw the President Trump talking about opportunity zones, those are some of the kind of tax incentives that are there to build, and they're building space out there. But you know, studios want to attract the best talent and actors and crew. They're here in California, and so there is an effort to find more spaces to film and build more sound stages.
So what kind of development is happening to maybe create more of that production space?
So part of it, I mean, it seems like this is, even though this has been a problem that has clearly been going on for a few years, I mean, the one reliable number that we have right now from Film LA is from 2016-17, where occupancy was at 96%. And that was before this whole, like, streaming wars thing happened. And you know, so now we expect it to be about 100%. And from my understanding, is that, you know, the people at LA County are having meetings to, you know, look at ways to incentivize people building. But they're also looking at things like, you know, in Boyle Heights, the famous County General Hospital, which has been sort of like dormant for about the past decade and was the backdrop to the famous ABC soap opera. They're looking to open part of that up to filming. And with that, sort of maybe entice the local workforce and bring that the community into the whole filming industry.
You know, a lot of people, a lot of big actors and actresses live in Hollywood. The production that goes along with it, they live here in L.A. or at least in the outskirts of L.A. So I'm wondering, with other places offering lucrative tax breaks, why are studios choosing to invest in infrastructure here in L.A.?
Well, this is the thing. So California has, over the past few years, really revamped its tax incentives. They've increased it. I think they go out something like $330 million a year. Now, in some states like New Mexico, what they did is they removed a cap to people and companies like Netflix who committed to a 10-year build on a studio. So they can make limitless claims on the state for tax incentives. In California, it's still quite limited. Now, they you know, it's a sort of like a balance, you know, for studios. They can get some money from California and stay here and keep all their crew and actors here and all their gear, and they don't have to spend the money to go and build out somewhere else. So it's sort of like a tension that they have to balance. But you know, you are seeing some build and this kind of like revolution of independent studios springing up in Santa Clarita. If you live there, then you're definitely familiar.
I was going to ask you about it because it was a me, or am I seeing more stuff in Sun Valley too?
Definitely.
Right?
Yeah. Sun Valley has this huge 200,000 square foot studio that's being built by Santa Clarita Studios, and Line 204 is building there. They're the ones building that. Sorry, and then that is going to be the biggest studio built in like 30 years. So, you know, there's a lot going on there. You know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was filmed there, Ford versus Ferrari. They've really done a lot, because it's not just about incentives and rebates. It's also about, is the area making it easier for you to cut, you know, close roads and give out permits and things like that.
Anousheh Saghoui, staff writer for the LA Times. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
All right, now to a goodbye. The witness tree in Agoura Hills is coming down, and its admirers have a chance to bid it adieu tomorrow. The towering Valley Oak has long stood on the Western film set at Paramount Ranch, and it got its name, like other witness trees, because it's been present for many key events in history, witnessing them all. It was, however, badly burned in the Woolsey Fire, which destroyed the structures surrounding it. Biologist Mark Mendelson with the National Park Service says there was hope for the tree when it sent out several green sprouts from its blackened branches last spring.
You know, we had good rains following the Woolsey Fire, so it really responded to that well. But then, you know, it had to make it through our summer drought-like conditions, and that's where it seemed to have maybe not had enough reserves.
The buildings that were under its canopy may have contributed to its demise. The film set that caught fire there likely burned hotter than the vegetation that surrounded the surviving trees nearby. And if you'd like to say goodbye, head on out to Paramount Ranch tomorrow between 2 and 4. Visitors will be invited to guess the age of the witness tree because, while likely more than a century old, no one really knows for sure. Once the tree is cut down toward the end of the month, the rings of the tree will be counted. And we're going to update you once we finally know how old it is. Since Helen Ray's set up shop in Chinatown 5 years ago and started serving up hot chicken sandwiches, it seems to have started an arms race in L.A. to see what sandwich can scorch your mouth the most. I have loved every minute because for me, when it comes to food, the hotter the better, or so I thought. Coming up, a hot chicken sandwich that really clucked me up. And I got it in all places at a car wash in the San Fernando Valley. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. By day, the Fashion Square Car Wash in Sherman Oaks is just a regular old car wash. But after it closes and the sun sets, a transformation occurs. A white cargo van pulls into the parking lot. Something like 8 people jump out and begin unloading tables, chairs, and fryers. Yeah, chicken fryers. Welcome to Hot Mother Clucker, one of the many San Fernando Valley pop-ups serving tongue-scorching, Southern-inspired fried chicken. LAS contributor Fiona Chandra recently wrote about the San Fernando Valley's hot fried chicken, and we thought it would make a great Food Friday segment for us. So she and I headed over to the Valley one chilly evening to eat and also talk about how this trend got started.
The first one opened in 2017. And so it's been only in the last 2-3 years. So I guess, you know, hot chicken has been a hot dish in LA.
That's
ever
right.
Since.
That was on purpose. You said it on purpose,
yes.
Didn't you?
Ever since Howlin' Ray's opened and became such a big hit. But in the Valley, it's been maybe in the last 2-3 years that now there are 5 of them that have opened in car washers in the area.
It just seems like an odd thing, though, a very specific thing. What about the two seems to work, at least so far?
So I think for the most part, it's a cost-saving measure. There's basically startups with not a lot of capital to open a brick-and-mortar place.
They're basically pop-ups, right? Yeah.
They're basically pop-ups, and the car washers don't open at night. There's a large space available for them to set up with, like, tables and fryers and everything. So it seems to be a good symbiotic relationship for the two.
But, so the car wash owners, they're good with it? Or is this one of those things where they're doing a pop-up and the owners of the car wash don't know about it?
So these ones, the owners do know about it. So these guys have been here for a couple of years. They have an existing relationship so far, and everything seems to be working well for both.
Definitely has a kind of a cool, funky vibe to it. There's music playing, too. There's crowd lined up already. Actually, right before 7 o'clock when it opened, people were already kind of getting ready. So what is it about LA, you think, that has fostered really this hot fried chicken boom that we're going through?
We'd attribute it for the most part to Howland Ray's. Okay. That's what's really been driving the popularity of it. But, you know, of course, the food itself is delicious, and I don't know, maybe people in LA like the spicy challenge as well.
Considering that they're concentrated in the San Fernando Valley, what are some of the other hot chicken spots out here?
So there is the Hawaiian Hot Chicken in Northridge. That's also a very popular one. It's close to the university there. There's Spicy Birds. There's also like Chips and Chicks that cover their hot chicken with Flamin' Hot Cheetos. Mm. So you get both trends that way. And then there's also like Raging Hot Chicken, which is the first one that opened in the Valley.
Yeah, that was the first one. They're the OG hot fried chicken place,
in
right?
The Valley.
In the Valley, yeah. Yeah. And in the way it looks, at least from a quick glance, is like it's like you're in your backyard and you're making fried chicken. It kind of has this very raw feel to it, as if it was put together today and now a bunch of guys are doing it. How many of these guys are trained chefs at all? Or are they just guys that know how to make good hot fried chicken?
They're not trained chefs, yes. Okay. They're just guys who started making the food at home. Most of them, they go to another hot chicken place, they go to Nashville or go to Howland Ray's in Chinatown. They love the food so much that they started making it at home. And it's good enough that their friends love it and started telling them, you need to sell this. And that's how I think all of these got started.
All right, now we put it in order and we got our food pretty quickly. So what did we get?
We got a hot chicken sandwich, the medium heat with some honey, a couple of sliders, and chicken tender, which A here has gotten the clucked up level.
That's the highest, hottest level that this place has here in Sherman Oaks. And I was advised, Fiona, to have the honey to go along with them. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that because I don't want to kill my throat. I actually have to do a show,
a radio show
at some point. So I'm going to give that a try with the honey. So here we go. Ooh, okay. So it is crispy, it is juicy, but the heat is overwhelming right away. And the heat is taking over the roof of my mouth, my tongue, my cheeks, under my tongue. Wow. And it's getting stronger. Oh my God. It feels like Satan's hand is wrapped around my tongue and he's squeezing it. Wow. All right, Fiona, how's yours?
Okay, well, I have the medium heat chicken sandwich, which also comes with pickles and slaw, and I put some honey on it, so I think that would help temper the heat more than the chicken tenders.
I think it's affecting my brain now. I think it's moved to my brain.
I think this one is just the right amount of heat for me.
Thanks for telling me now, Fiona.
It's definitely crispy and juicy. Just got enough kick. You're welcome to have some of the medium.
Well, I'm glad you're doing well, Fiona. So if someone, Fiona, wants to challenge these places, what should they have in mind when they come to these places? Especially if they think that they can handle heat on a chicken sandwich.
I mean, if they're only going to come once and they just want to try the hottest one, uh-huh. Yes, they can go ahead and do that. But yeah. For me, usually you come and you take it a level below and see if you can handle that.
Yeah.
And then move up accordingly.
Like a ladder, right?
Like a ladder,
you wouldn't
exactly.
Start at the top of the ladder.
Train.
You'd stop at the you start at the bottom, right? Yeah. All right. Well, Fiona, thanks for telling me about this place. Any doctor's bills I might just forward to you at this point.
Oh, no. Forward to KBCC.
That's Fiona Chandra, LAist contributor, telling us about some of the hot fried chicken sandwich places in car washes in, of all places, the San Fernando Valley. Fiona, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
This is why I'm hot. This is why I'm hot. This is why. This is why. This is why I'm hot. This is why I'm hot. This is why I'm hot. This is why. This is why. This is why I'm hot. I'm hot cause I'm fly. You ain't cause you not.
It hurts so much. All right, finally, with a whole weekend ahead of you, we can help you out if you're looking for something to do.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez. We are going to go almost all Hollywood today because, of course, this Sunday are the Oscars.
Why not?
Yeah. So for those of you looking for an Oscars viewing party, then head to the Dynasty Typewriter Theater in Westlake. So the doors open at 5 o'clock, and you'll be able to fill out your ballots, have some Oscar-themed drinks, and more. Plus, have you ever wanted to give an acceptance speech?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
so
yes.
Here's your chance. During the commercials, they're going to open up the mic so you can actually go up on stage, pick an award, make up an award, accept it for anything you'd like, then thank your agent, your family, whatever. I'm very serious. I can see you furrowing your brow, thinking like, okay,
I already got it.
What's the award?
I would like to thank no one but me for this award.
What's the award?
Best anything of anything.
Okay, congratulations. I'm so glad I know you. Wow. So when you want to go to this at Dynasty Typewriter Theater, it is free with RSVP.
All right, so what if I want to check out some more celebrities this weekend?
Well, technically not in person, but you can see them in some great photographs at the Annenberg Space for Photography in Century City. Tomorrow, it's debuting a new exhibit called Vanity Fair Hollywood Calling. So the space is collaborating with Vanity Fair to display over 100 iconic images taken for the magazine, featuring celebs in cover photo shoots, candidates from parties over the years, and more. We're talking about works by people like Annie Leibovitz and Helmut Newton. And this exhibit is open until late July, and when you go to that one, it's free.
All right, now finally, what if Hollywood is far from my mind? What can I do then?
Okay, well, how about going to a play, a little off-screen action? Starting tonight is a two-weekend run of Frida, Stroke of Passion. It's a new play, and it'll be at the theater Casa 0101 in Boyle Heights. And this staging tells the story of the complex last days of Frida Kahlo's life. When you go, tickets start at $25. Now, that is not all. There's actually a whole much more going on, and the KPCC LAS gang have a lot more to share of what to do this weekend. You can check out our full list of events on LAIST.com. That is LAIST.com. Also, if you want to, you can find me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat.
That's our own Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later, eh?
That's it for Take Two this week. Our producers are Lori Captain Skywalker Galaretta and Leo Duran. Austin Cross directs the show. Ari Saperstein helped out this week. The program is engineered by Hazmik Bogosian. Megan Larson is the senior producer and editor. Ami Martinez, thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.